We're talking about legal recourse for people facing eviction in Milwaukee. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. The Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors, it will consider a resolution today on a pilot program called Right to Counsel for county residents who face eviction. The Wisconsin Policy Forum, it analyzed census data and found more than half of Milwaukee households who rent homes spend at least 30% of their income on rent and fall into the category of rent burdened. What is it like to be a renter in Milwaukee? Have you faced eviction before? Did you have access to legal services? 800-642-1234. Ryan Clancy is county supervisor for the 4th District of Milwaukee County. He's a restaurant owner in the Bayview neighborhood. Ryan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much, Kate. Appreciate you having me and bringing some light on this important legislation.
Well, let's dig right in. Explain for us what you've put together in this Right to Counsel resolution.
Yeah, thanks. So later on today, we're going to be considering a resolution that has two parts. One is declaring the right to counsel. And what that means is that every resident of Milwaukee County, you know, regardless of means, should have access to an attorney if they're facing eviction and foreclosure or foreclosure. And the other part of that is funding that. So for a year and a half, funding a team of dedicated lawyers and support staff who would make that right a reality.
How many lawyers would you have?
So there's it's roughly 20 staff overall. There's going to be about 12 full-time dedicated attorneys. There'll be some money in there for hours for, kind of contracts, things like that. But about 12 full-time lawyers and a support staff to do intake and support them.
Where would the funding come from?
So the funding would come from the ARPA funds, so the American Rescue Plan Act federal funds. It's an incredibly efficient use of those funds. It's during an emergency, so it meets all those requirements. And my hope and my expectation is that, after the first year and a half, we're going to have the data, the really compelling data that we've seen from other places like Cleveland and New York, to be able to continue this in a more permanent way. And also to make this just part of a larger strategy. So also investing upstream, making sure that people, for instance, know what their contracts say before they sign them, and that we continue with the really important deployment of rental assistance, kind of direct rental assistance, which has kept, 5,480 folks in their homes during the pandemic that wouldn't otherwise have been there.
Well, I want to look at other models in other states in a moment. But what resonates with me is when we talked with the housing coordinator for Legal Action of Wisconsin about evictions last summer, one thing that stuck with me is mediation. That so often the situation ends in an eviction filing because there wasn't proper communication and conflict resolution between landlord and tenant. And so what role does mediation have in your proposal?
Yeah, absolutely. So mediation is a great tool to have in the tool chest. Ultimately, we still need an absolute right to counsel because what we often see is that folks who are in the position of being evicted, do not or cannot show up for things like court dates. I'm very opposed to mandatory mediation, but very grateful for the folks doing it on the ground as an option because often, it doesn't just come down to do you have the rent or not. Often there are bigger issues about, living conditions or, the state of the housing and all that. And those things are things that are appropriate for mediation. But kind of a yes and approach where we offer mediation, but we also ensure that everybody has access to the lawyer seems to be the best way to cover everyone and to bring things to a successful resolution. I've talked to many landlords who were excited about this and that I didn't expect them to be because if their tenants have access to legal counsel, it actually streamlines things and they can get to a successful resolution for everyone a little bit faster.
What outcomes would you expect if your resolution goes through? I mean, what type of benchmarks would you be looking for?
Sure. So some of the easier data to qualify is were people able to stay in their homes? Were we able to come to a resolution between the landlord and the tenant? If we look at places like Cleveland, their data is stunning and overwhelming. And people that are served by this are able to avoid eviction about 90% of the time. I mean, that's ultimately the goal, right? The other things, and I think the even more important effects and sometimes the ignored ones are, not just keeping a tenant in their home, which is absolutely a great thing, but the idea that that tenant is more likely to keep their job. They're more likely, if they have children in the household, that their children will stay in school, that their performance in school will do better, and even that their lead levels are lower as a result of not picking up and moving into different, often precarious housing as a result of eviction. So there are the numbers that we can see that are really apparent, and the tremendous positive effects of legislation like this that's a little bit harder to quantify sometimes, but is definitely real. I mean, I've heard some really deeply personal and compelling stories from folks across the county who have been, you know, impacted by eviction and foreclosure, and have just seen their lives altered irreparably. So I'm really looking forward to those broader effects here too.
We're talking with Ryan Clancy, Milwaukee County Supervisor. He's explaining his right to counsel proposal before supervisors today, providing access to legal aid for residents facing eviction. What do you think of a proposal like this in your community? Are you facing eviction as a result of the COVID crisis? What is your story? What do you think about the Milwaukee County trying to do to help tenants? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ryan, what I'm hearing from you is this type of proposal could, you know, really have a ripple effect, that it could promote stability in aspects of life that we may not think about, like, your health, your stability at work, how healthy your children are. Can you kind of explain the scope and the history of the eviction problem in Milwaukee?
Absolutely. I mean, you're right. I mean, it's a public health issue. It's an equity issue. I mean, when we look at the folks most impacted by eviction specifically, we're looking at Black women are disproportionately targeted by this, especially Black women heads of household. And it is it's not something that's been recent. I mean, the eviction moratorium has kind of changed the data. But prior to the pandemic, we've been looking at an average of about 14,000 evictions in Milwaukee County every year. It's a crisis. And this is one that has been a long time coming. But I'm glad that we can kind of work towards a solution on it.
Yeah, I was looking at Princeton's Eviction Lab line graph tracking Milwaukee's eviction trends over time. I'm sure you've seen it. And, you know, this time last year, there was a huge spike in evictions. Looking at that year over year data, do you expect that to happen again if the federal moratorium is moved to the end of July? What might happen?
Yeah, it's, I'm grateful that it looks like the moratorium will be extended, that it won't end in 6 days, and that it'll end instead in 1 month and 6 days. But there is going to be a floodgate of evictions. I've talked to many tenants who are just counting down the days until they lose their housing. So I want to be sure that I am very hopeful that this will pass this morning, but I also want to set people's expectations that we will not be able to go 0-60 on this within that month and to train all of those attorneys and set everything up. It is very important. It's vital that we pass this today and that we get it up and running. But certainly there's going to be an uphill battle in terms of reaching those thousands of people who are scheduled to be evicted as soon as that moratorium ends.
I mean, you know, that is a good point. What is the timeline? How quickly could you scale up and get a program like this up and running?
Right. So fortunately, we have really amazing, dedicated people on the ground right now from, you know, Legal Aid, Legal Action, who have been doing this work with very few resources. And the idea is not to start from scratch and to really learn, you know, work with them, take their lessons, and just provide more support for the work that's already happening, but that hasn't had the dollars to be as effective as we'd like it to be. It's going to be a struggle, but it's important that we do what we can as soon as we can, rather than waiting until everything is in place and perfect. So the right will happen, I believe, in 6 days when it's signed into law. I know that the people on the ground through the Department of Health and Human Services, that their housing division is incredible. And they have a lot of leeway in kind of how those dollars are going to be distributed as quickly as possible.
We're talking about evictions and a right to counsel proposal on the table in Milwaukee. Ryan Clancy is County Supervisor for the 4th District of Milwaukee County. Do you think every tenant should have the right to legal representation? How helpful do you think legal help would be in solving housing issues? Are you a landlord? What are your biggest concerns here? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Ryan Clancy on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The national moratorium on evictions may be extended by 30 days, sunsetting at the end of July. The Biden administration signaled yesterday its plans, citing concerns over a new wave of evictions. That reporting by the New York Times and other outlets. A right to counsel resolution. It goes before the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors today. Do you think the ban on evictions should continue until the economy is more stable? Is there a better solution? What should be done to stop a wave of evictions around the state? Join in 800-642-1234. Ryan Clancy is a county supervisor for the 4th District of Milwaukee County and stays with us. So, Ryan, what are you hearing out of landlords when it comes to this proposal, this right to counsel?
I had assumed, frankly, when I first proposed this, put in the report, you know, last November, that we'd face kind of unified opposition from landlords. As it turns out, the best landlords out there are very much in favor of this. When this was in front of committee, in front of finance last week, my colleague, Patty Logsdon, who I think she would agree with my assessment that she is among the more conservative folks on the board, started her speech from the floor by saying that this was expensive and that she anticipated the same thing, that landlords would hate it. And then she said how she talked to landlords and that they supported it and that they, you know, they are not the best landlords out there, the ones that are not the absentee out-of-state landlords, the one actually is the ones trying to invest in the community to the extent that they can, are okay with their tenants having legal representation. Because why wouldn't you be if the goal was not to just, you know, turn people out on the street? And she added her name as a co-sponsor. And I am incredibly grateful to have this in common with a colleague that I sometimes don't. And the support, I think, both from my colleagues and from the community has been amazing. I mean, the United Way has pledged $1.5 million towards this over the next 5 years. We've had just a huge, broad array of community groups really stepping up and saying that this is something that will make a significant, very real impact in the lives of thousands of people.
So under this proposal, what might change for landlords with eviction filings? What would be different?
Yeah, so I mean, the filing essentially would be similar. It would, you know, be the 5-day notice and the, you know, that my hope and the expectations that, you know, are based on data in other places where those filings actually go down. If you're an unscrupulous landlord and you don't really have a leg to stand on legally, but you just want a tenant out for a reason that's not related to something legitimate, like non-payment of rent, you're less likely to file that eviction in the first place. In fact, I think in Cleveland, New York, they saw a 30% reduction in the number of filings to begin with. And the first thing that this does is to get rid of some of those more frivolous actions from lawyers trying to get their tenants out. Even when something does get to court or does get filed, they tend to be resolved faster when there's a lawyer on both sides, because landlords already have lawyers for the most part. I mean, it's well above 90% in terms of representation on the landlord side. But in Milwaukee and in most places, less than 3% of tenants have lawyers. Hmm. So, you know, evening that playing field a little bit and having lawyers who are familiar with, you know, tenant-landlord law talk this out on behalf of their clients really does provide a lot of equity and makes things better. I mean, more people stay in their homes ultimately.
Cleveland, Ohio is popping up here and there as we talk. And I'm wondering, you know, when you mentioned 93% of cases were able to avoid an eviction or an involuntary move, what is going on in Cleveland?
Yeah, it's fantastic. And I think the data that we've seen there and in New York, it really underlines the fact that we can spend a relatively small amount of money to make a really huge difference in the lives of people. But yeah, it's... Yeah, I mean, and those numbers are stunning because that's after those evictions are filed. It doesn't even, those numbers don't count the many evictions that aren't filed in the first place because landlords know that they might face opposition unless their claim is a legal and reasonable one. But yeah, I mean, that's ultimately what we're after. It is not just, delaying somebody's eviction, but it's working things out between the landlord and the tenant. Because often it doesn't just come down to rent, but that sometimes it does. And one of the reasons I'm excited about having this program under the Department of Health and Human Services with the county is that those are the same folks that have access, at least right now during the pandemic, to those rental assistant dollars, where they can meet somebody who is, facing eviction and say, what is the problem? If the problem is just rent, if they were impacted by the pandemic or something else, and we can provide them some dollars to get them current on rent, and that was the only issue, then that's also a great resolution to this. So I think having kind of a full, support services array available to folks instead of just saying, well, we'll give you a lawyer and that's going to just delay the inevitable for a month. But actually looking at not only if they're behind on rent, but why they're behind on rent and providing some additional support there, I think is one of the reasons that the Cleveland and other places are doing so well. And that's the goal here in Milwaukee.
And it seems like you do have that supporting data that so many Milwaukee renters and households are rent burdened. Do people in Milwaukee, all of those renters, are they paying a lot to stay in their homes?
It is. I mean, we're paying a huge amount of our monthly income towards housing, and the options out there are just not good. I mean, we're trying to help a friend of the family to get his first apartment. He joined us from another country, and being that close to his story is just heartbreaking. He's applied for I've lost track of the dozens of places that he's applied for and the scores of them that he's looked at. But it's really difficult to find safe, supportive, and affordable housing here in Milwaukee. One of my hopes is that this legislation will make Milwaukee less desirable for these kind of out-of-state absentee landlords that are buying up a lot of the housing stock, that are preventing folks from buying, sometimes their first home because these out-of-state landlords are showing up with a lot of cash and really swamping any person who might have to finance their first place. And are taking a lot of that, more affordable housing stock and increasing the prices on it. So my hope is that these out-of-state landlords, the ones that are not investing in the community, will look elsewhere and will go to other markets and let the smaller landlords and first-time homeowners really put down some roots here.
Ryan Clancy is with us, Milwaukee County Board Supervisor, 4th District. We're discussing his right to counsel resolution. Have you applied for rental assistance? Do you feel you're rent burdened, or are you in the process of applying for rental assistance? What questions do you have about how the process works? What do you see out there as you look to rent a home in the city of Milwaukee? 800-642-1234 to join in. Ryan, you mentioned this proposal, how it might also affect things upstream in housing in Milwaukee. What might be the ripple effect of this proposal, especially as you look around the boardroom at your fellow supervisors?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really looking forward to to all these other effects. I mean, looking at the on the face of it, the cost of it is about $2 million a year, and that sounds like a lot until you realize, how much that is, per eviction that we can prevent. I mean, between this and looking at the Department of Health and Human Services and the amazing effects that they've been able to have with taking rental assistance dollars and giving those directly to people that need them during the pandemic. And again, that was 5,480 evictions that were prevented through the application of dollars, really underlines the idea that if we prioritize spending money on human needs and not on punitive things and some of the things that always get the headlines, that it works. And I think I'm confident that this is going to pass this morning. And I'm confident that we're going to have the data in a year and a half to keep this going, and that we're going to be able to, maintain a focus on human needs, which is really why government exists and why the county government specifically exists in the first place.
As we wrap up here very quickly, you have a restaurant. I'm just wondering how it's going right now as a restaurant owner in the pandemic.
Boy, we had a restaurant. We hope to open back up, and we will need some of those restaurant relief funds that are being blocked by the SBA or by a lawsuit for the SBA in order to open back up. So I hope to be an employer again soon, but yeah, time will tell on that.
Ryan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you having me, Kate.
Ryan Clancy is a Milwaukee County Board Supervisor. Ahead this hour, we talk with the City of Milwaukee's new health commissioner about battling this stage of the pandemic and other pressing health issues in our city. What do you want to ask the health commissioner? 800-642-1234. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Art Preserve in Sheboygan officially opened Saturday after being delayed due to the pandemic. An annex of the John Michael Kohler Art Center, the museum will make history as the first ever dedicated to artist-built environments. Megan Hart has more.
On the museum's first floor, there's an enclosed section dedicated to the Milwaukee County artist Eugene von Brinckenhain. It's 1,600 square feet, but it feels smaller.
And this is the actual footprint of his house. It's not the layout, but it is the size to kind of give people a sense of how dense they must have been living.
It's filled with towering display cases full of his colorful creations. Curator Laura Bickford says von Brinckenhain made profusely, painting, writing, and photographing his wife, Marie.
He dug clay from his yard and made crowns and vessels that he would fire in his oven.
Back in April, many of his works were already in place, but there were still a couple of empty spots. They were waiting on von Brinckenhain's towers, made from poultry bones and model airplane glue. Some are several feet tall, and moving them is no easy task. In fact, it highlights one of Art Preserve's central themes. How do we conserve and display works that were never meant for museums? In a way, the story of Art Preserve starts with von Brinckenhain. Ruth Kohler, former director of the John Michael Kohler Art Center, visited his home in West Allis after he died in 1983.
She instantly sort of realized, like, we can't just have one painting. Like, no one will understand the kind of breadth and depth of his world. And so the first acquisition the Art Center made was about 6,000 objects that came out of his house.
Art Preserve isn't just for outsider art. The museum doesn't even use the term. In fact, its collection includes some real art world insiders, like Stella Waitzkin, who studied with William de Kooning and lived in the Chelsea Hotel, a residential hotel that was home to many prominent New York City artists in the second half of the 20th century. She cast hundreds of books in resin, a metaphor on knowledge.
And she called her apartment Details of a Lost Library.
Now they sparkle like gems at Art Preserve. For Sam Gatmeyer, executive director of the Art Center, it's intention that sets artist-built environments apart. They're meant to be experienced as a whole.
You know, I think about it in contrast to sort of the norm, which is artists that create serial one-off pieces, right? I make a painting, I sell it. I make another painting, I sell it.
One of Wisconsin's most famous artist-built environments is Fred Smith's Concrete Sculpture Park up in Phillips. He also owned a bar where he sold Rhinelander shorties. Instead of a ticket counter, the first thing museum goers encounter is a space set up to evoke his establishment.
These kind of reliefs up there were once behind his bar. We kind of use photos at the bar to kind of recreate it, and we're working with a Milwaukee-based artist named John Riepenhoff to brew a Fred Smith lager.
You can still visit Smith's Park and Bar in Phillips, but it's not always possible to preserve artist-built environments where they stand. That's where Art Preserve comes in. Ultimately, its collection celebrates the impulse to create. Gatmeyer envisions a Venn diagram when considering its place in the art world.
For example, most of the artists at the Art Preserve are self-taught, but not all of them are. So one circle we intersect with is self-taught artists. And of course, with the institutions like Intuit in Chicago and the Folk Art Museum in New York.
But no other museum places such a focus on artist-built environments. Art Preserve also overlaps with institutions like the Museum of Wisconsin Art that use visible storage to display their collection. Everything is out in the open. The museum is free to visit, and there's plenty to explore on its three floors. But Bickford always ends her tours in the same spot, Emery Blagden's healing machine. The Nebraska artist spent his life investigating Earth's electromagnetism. He filled his shed with sparkling mobiles made from everyday objects like wire, Christmas lights, and bows from the local pharmacy. Blagden called them his pretties.
We call it an artist-built environment. It could equally be a science experiment. Like, it is a huge sculpture. Maybe it's a machine.
In the end, she says the power is not in the words we use to describe artist-built environments. Rather, it's in the way they bend genres and make us reconsider what constitutes art. Megan Hart, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now to the city of Milwaukee's Commissioner of Health. Kirsten Johnson has been on the job for about 4 months. She formerly headed up the Washington Ozaukee Public Health Department, merging them and establishing an independent board of health. She was director and health officer for about 5 years. Are you a Milwaukeean? What do you think of the city's response to the pandemic and where vaccinations stand now? It's 800-642-1234. Commissioner Kirsten Johnson, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
So when you started your job, you said unsurprisingly that your number one goal is to lead Milwaukee out of this public health crisis. How is the city doing battling COVID at this point?
So I think we've done a tremendous job. I can't say enough about the City of Milwaukee Health Department and the work they've done over the last year. But, you know, as of today, our burden, so the number of cases per 100,000 is just over 11, so 11.4. And our test positivity is 1.1, which is the lowest we've seen since the beginning of the pandemic. And we have 52% of our population fully with their first dose of vaccine and 47% fully vaccinated. Still have a lot of work to do. And we are, you know, continuing to try to be creative in that space. But I think we've done a great job.
All right. So the city itself then trending above Milwaukee County there and pretty much on par with the state average. Is that what you're seeing?
That is absolutely what we're seeing. We have pockets of the community of the city who are at lower vaccination rates. But we at this point, just this week, have pivoted to really a canvassing neighborhood initiative process. We have staff literally going door to door offering vaccine to people.
Wait, talk to me a little bit more about that. You're canvassing neighborhoods, going door to door, offering vaccines, like literally knocking on the door saying, hey, is someone unvaccinated here? Would you like a vaccine now?
Yes, that's what we're doing. We're doing it in partnership with some community organizations who have done trainings. So we have community health workers, influencers, mobilizers who are going with our staff door to door, knocking, giving education, trying to make people comfortable having conversations. And then if they're interested, offering vaccine.
Would that be a J&J vaccine then, a one-shot dose?
Nope, we offer both Pfizer and J&J.
Okay.
So we'll come back.
So you would come back to that home. What about the Delta variant there? What is the impact? It's a, you know, fast-spreading mutation of COVID. What are you seeing in Milwaukee?
So we've only seen a handful of cases that have actually been sequenced of the Delta variant in Wisconsin or in Milwaukee. I think there's about 30 in the state. But that's just a small sampling of the total number of cases. So I think it's here. I mean, it does give me pause. I am concerned about the pockets of our city that are unvaccinated or have a lower vaccination rate. But if you are vaccinated, the good news is that the vaccine works against the Delta variant. So I think we're really, we're really kind of racing against time. We're in the summer, which is great for us in Wisconsin because we're primarily outdoors. We like to gather outdoors. So that is helpful. But again, I think we really need to work hard over the course of the summer to get vaccine in as many arms as we can.
Okay, so there's the door-to-door canvassing. What other efforts are you doing to try to get vaccinations up?
So we're partnering with local organizations and businesses. You know, our sports teams here in Milwaukee have been tremendous partners through the entire pandemic. So the Brewers and Bucks have been generously offering tickets and, you know, get a shot, get a ticket. We have an event tomorrow with the Bucks. So if you get vaccinated tomorrow before the Bucks game, you will be entered into a raffle to receive playoff tickets. So really sort of exciting initiatives. Summerfest has done a tremendous job. So 2 or 3 weeks ago, we did a drive-through event there and they gave Summerfest tickets for every shot. We're trying to be creative and really target the populations that we know have lower vaccination rates. So, you know, the younger age groups, 30 and under, the canvassing that we're doing in communities is really, and sort of currently started in the northwest side of our city, really trying to address some of those racial disparities we're seeing as well.
We're talking with Kirsten Johnson, Commissioner of Health for the City of Milwaukee. She started the job in March. You can join in. Do you live in Milwaukee? What do you think of the city's response? Has someone knocked on your door to find out if everyone is vaccinated and if someone needs a vaccination? What do you make of efforts to get vaccines out to people in your community? Join in, 800-642-1234. You know, there is some reporting out this morning saying, look, Milwaukee youth vaccination rates are behind state averages. What are you seeing out of youth in vaccinations?
So we are vaccinating youth. Again, I think we're trying to really target and make vaccine readily available, trying to, you know, eliminate any and all barriers to vaccine being available to youth. We partnered with MPS and other non-MPS schools this spring to get vaccine in arms. We have a large back-to-school event this in late July, early August, where we'll be offering vaccine there as well. You know, the door-to-door campaign. We have an event this weekend that hopefully will draw a large number of young people. I think, again, just trying to be creative in where we're offering. Also, our healthcare partners have been tremendous in this space. And I think as we move forward in our vaccination efforts, we're really going to be leaning into our healthcare partners. You know, at every time someone walks in their door, hopefully there'll be an opportunity to get somebody to be vaccinated. So it's thinking about kids and their annual appointments and back to school appointments. Hopefully we'll be able to capture more there.
Yeah, I'm just curious what that back to school vaccination effort might look like as you partner with Milwaukee Public Schools.
So again, this spring, we offered vaccine at four different schools, multiple days a week. I imagine we're going to do something similar in the fall. And like I mentioned, we have a large back to school event planned. It's 2 days, two Fridays, the last Friday of July and the first Friday in August. Again, really targeting our students in the city of Milwaukee and hoping to get them vaccinated before they go back.
When you look at how the city has done in mask wearing and health orders that expired in late May, the city had fined businesses more than $250,000 for violating these orders. What do you see at the intersection of fines, enforcement, and public health?
So I think the orders were tremendously effective early on in the pandemic. We put our orders in place, I believe it was before my time here at the health department, but I believe it was in June, July. And it was very effective at sort of bringing our business and community partners together to understand safety and mitigation measures. And it was very effective at implementing masking as well. I think for anyone who's traveled to Milwaukee over the course of the last year and outside of Milwaukee, you could see a marked difference in the city. And frankly, you still can see that. We are supporting any business that it continues to ask patrons to mask. So I think it made a significant impact on the spread in the city. Again, last summer, last fall, the rates in the city were lower than the surrounding communities. I think that's something to be proud of. As we were moving through the winter, and again, as our rates and our burden started to improve, it just became time to lift those orders and recognize the tremendous work that our community partners and businesses have done. But also we did some work with our epidemiologists and really were comfortable that our burden was going to continue to fall. And sure enough, it has.
Milwaukee Health Commissioner Kirsten Johnson with us explaining her public health approach at this stage in the pandemic. What steps should the city take in combating the pandemic? What about lead poisoning? What about racial inequities in healthcare? Are you concerned about the more contagious Delta variant? Do you have questions about CDC guidance or masks with your unvaccinated child? Join in on Milwaukee Public Health. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking with the City of Milwaukee's Health Commissioner, Kirsten Johnson, who's been on the job for 4 months, previously Director of the Washington and Ozaukee Public Health Department. She's also been a health policy fellow at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Still time to talk about public health policy for Milwaukee, how you see it in your neighborhood, 800-642-1234. And Commissioner Johnson is with us for about 10 more minutes. I want to talk about turnover in your department. Before you, Jeanette Kowalik held the position for about 2 years. Before her, Bevan Baker had the job for about 13 years. you know, how long does it take to fully understand this job and to shape and advance health policy and programs in Milwaukee?
So I'd say it takes more than 4 months. you know, it takes time, absolutely. You know, this department has gone through, obviously, a lot of change, and change is really difficult. And then I add on top of it a pandemic. So I think as we move towards recovery, my one of my biggest goals is really to build or rebuild the foundation of this department, and work on a strategic plan that aligns all of our work across all of the areas that we focus on. So LED, Office of Violence Prevention, Maternal and Child Health, our lab, so that we all are working towards collective goals to really systemically address racism, to think very critically about social determinants of health, and how do we partner with our other community organizations to address some of those things. And it takes time to do that work. I think my goal as a leader in this role is I would like us to be in a very strong place and an influential in state policy and potentially even federal policy in 3 years. So I know it's going to take time, but I think we have a really incredible opportunity in the city of Milwaukee to do some great work.
So, and you've said before you're a systems thinker, and I kind of hear systems as you explain that there are so many problems that are really interconnected, and that you know, kind of lapse into something else as well when you mention lead there and you know, systemic racism. Can you explain that a little bit about how these issues are interconnected?
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about systemic racism, and the social determinants of health, which I really are arguably the political determinants of health, it's directly related to lead. So thinking about neighborhoods where Black and Brown communities were allowed to live based on policy, where they were allowed to invest in community and buy homes. You know, it's the oldest housing stock in the city. It's deteriorating. You know, again, there's been a lack of investment in education, so which in turn results in a lack of economic opportunity, and it's just perpetuating this issue. And lead specifically, you know, it's related to housing stock. And again, I would argue these are political determinants of health. These were policies that were put in place over the last 150 years that are perpetuating health inequities. And as a leader in the health department, and specifically in Milwaukee, I think we have an opportunity to really look closely at not only our own operations, but how do we address this as a city? How do we collaborate with other community partners, healthcare systems, and really leverage those relationships? You know, how do we foster a relationship with the legislature, with the state Department of Health? You know, how are we influential with our senators on the Hill? I think it's critically important in our role in public health in Milwaukee as the largest health department to be influential and to make strides in this work. You know, Milwaukee County and the city of Milwaukee declared racism as a public health crisis. It absolutely is. But what are we going to do about it? And that's why I'm here.
Yeah, I mean, former Commissioner Kwalik left the job last year. One reason she gave was that she felt, quote unquote, limited by Republican state lawmakers and a conservative leaning state Supreme Court. What role should state government have in the decisions you make in the decisions city health departments make in how they operate?
You know, that's a really, I think the pandemic has brought to light the interaction between state policy and state power making and how that interrelates with municipal or local public health making. So those orders that we can put in place, you know, the Supreme Court recently ruled in Wisconsin that, you know, it's local public health departments do not have the authority to close school districts. I think this is a tough conversation, but I think it's critically important that we as public health leaders, all of us, and are at the table to have those conversations. I do think, you know, I came from Washington, Nozaki County, two of the more conservative counties in the state, and I feel strongly that I was able to build relationships with my leaders and have them have a really good understanding of public health. We worked closely together. I respected their ideas and thoughts, and we were able to make progress in a way that I think has been stifled at the state largely. But again, it's really about fostering those relationships, creating partnerships and having those tough conversations, and public health absolutely has to be at the table.
I'm just thinking about all the public health leaders who have left their jobs over the stress of the pandemic, the stress coming from lawmakers and other areas. What do you make of that exodus?
It's not surprising. This has been the hardest year of my career. I think we've all, every single one of us has probably thought more than once, like, I can't do this anymore. I'm exhausted. I'm emotionally exhausted. I'm putting my entire life out there and my professional, credibility out on the line. And this has been really hard. And I'm not sure I can emphasize that enough. So I respect every single health commissioner, health officer who's left their role, because you also have to take care of yourself. And this has been, I can't emphasize enough, it's been a really difficult year.
Kirsten Johnson, Commissioner of Health for the City of Milwaukee, on the job since March. You can ask her a question, 800-642-1234. We heard from Kathy in Milwaukee, called, couldn't stay with us. And Kathy says they understand the racial disparities in vaccine rates and reasons for hesitancy in getting the COVID vaccine. And Kathy wonders, what is the city doing to address racial disparities and vaccine hesitancy?
So our effort really now is focused on utilizing trusted leaders in community, whether formal or informal, sort of in community influencers, individuals who live in communities and neighborhoods who've been vaccinated as the messengers. So it's so critically important that the messenger and the way that we communicate information is from someone that is respected and that people feel connected to. And I think we can all relate to that. So our door-to-door effort is really about meeting people where they are, having really honest conversations, not being judgmental, understanding that there are absolute reasons why people are hesitant and that we should respect those reasons, but also trying to communicate how critically important it is at this point in time to be vaccinated so we don't have to put health orders in place, that we don't have increasing hospitalization rates and that more people don't die. At this point, it's preventable, and we need to communicate that in the most culturally sensitive way we can.
Circling back to lead pipes, the program to replace lead pipes, lead service lines in Milwaukee is proposed to take generations, more than 70 years. Is that a timeline that you find realistic, or is that a timeline you're okay with as public health commissioner?
So, I think there's two different sources of lead really in Milwaukee. The predominant source of lead that is related to lead poisoning in children is paint and soil. So the health department's focus is really heavily on how do we abate homes? How do we eliminate the risk of peeling lead in some of these homes that are, older? My own home has lead in it. And one of my children has an elevated blood lead level because we're doing some construction. So just educating families about, just even that dust that gets generated is dangerous. The lead pipe piece, it is going to take many years because it's expensive to do. But in reality, in most cases, the water in our lead is pretty low in Milwaukee. And families can get their water tested from the tap. But in reality, where it's coming from and how our children are being poisoned is the paint and the soil.
Commissioner Johnson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Kirsten Johnson is Commissioner of Health for the City of Milwaukee. Stay with us. We examine the concept of dignity in public health politics, pop culture, law, how it relates to LGBTQ+ communities. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.